We are at the Aegeus Bowl, as you can see behind us, and Australia have just retained the Ashes. They have gone 8-6 up on points, I believe. To be honest, I'm completely shattered, so I'm probably going to get some of the details wrong, but the point is they won just about, despite Nat Zimmer-Brunt hitting 100. She couldn't quite manage it. You'd think it was 15 runs off the last over and then 5 off the last ball. There was a moment there when she hit that last one where I thought, this is going over the rope, and of course it wasn't, and it was just a single. And she looked a bit exhausted at the end, much like we are. Sid, what did you make of it all today?
Well, I mean, Nat Zimmer-Brunt was, you know, the star of the show very much, but you know, for the third time in her career, she's the only woman to have three times hit 100 in an ODI and to have come out on the losing side, and all three times against Australia. So she did it again today. We were right at the end. We were remembering the eliminator from the 100 last year, weren't we? Where Nat Zimmer-Brunt right at the end also hit a load of runs right at the end in that eliminator just out here. And she so nearly got the Trent Rockets over the line in that case as well, but you know, England just fell short. And you know, it's all about the small margins, isn't it, Raf? That England got really close, but Australia just made those small margins count just enough, didn't they?
Well, they did today, but I don't think that's necessarily been the story of the series. Perhaps that's something to reflect on in a minute. Obviously, one of the questions that a lot of people are talking about, and I'm sorry, Sid, because I know she's, you know, a fan favourite of yours, but Lauren Bell bowling that last over and getting tonked by Georgia Wareham. It was difficult to watch. Was that the moment that turned the game? Was that the moment that turned the series, maybe? Or was that a bit harsh?
Well, no, I think full credit to Georgia Wareham in that case. I'm not sure that Warren Bell did a whole heap wrong. You could argue that, you know, a couple of the deliveries weren't perfect, but they weren't, you know, she didn't send down five or six full tosses. You know, they were mostly reasonable deliveries, but, you know, Wareham was clearly in the mood and she can hit those big shots. She's already shown in this series, she showed in the T20 series that she can hit big at the end. You know, I mean, she's riding her luck, but that's what you need to do in that final over. And, you know, she coming in as their, like, Australia's number 8, I think, you know, she just, that's arguably, again, one of the differences. So Sarah Glenn coming in, a similar point, I think Sarah Glenn came in at 9 actually rather than 8. But, you know, she was very much, you know, just looking to try and get off strike and just try and keep the ball out. Whereas Wareham was, you know, stood big and was like, no, I'm going to hit it out of the ground. And that ultimately, you know, there's another difference.
Well, again, that was the difference today, but we saw a few days ago at Bristol, Kate Cross whipping out the ramp shot against Megan Shute, wasn't it? One of the best bowlers in the world, historically. So I just feel that, England have now lost the Ashes. There's no going back from here. Of course, they could still win the series. But to me, my Guardian piece that I wrote before today's game, which was about this series kind of representing the end of an era of green and gold dominance, I still think that holds true. I know you don't agree with me, Sid.
Well, I mean, I think that it's, you know, the consequences of the French Revolution, Raf, is too early to tell. You know, it is 10 years since Australia have lost 4 games on the trot. But, you know, let's see where we are in a year's time. This could be, certainly could be the start of, you know, a change in the guard. And, you know, it's true. I still maintain that fundamentally that Australia's next generation are not going to be quite as good as this one, because, you know, how do you top a generation that contains Meg Lanning and, you know, Elise Perry and Beth Mooney and Alyssa Healy? They're not going to be able to quite top that generation. But I still think there's a good chance that, you know, we're looking back in 8 years' time and seeing that Australia have won another 3 or 4 World Cups.
It was really interesting because in both of the post-match press conferences, we had Heather Knight from England and then we had Alana King from Australia, and they were both asked this question. I think it was Mel Farrell who asked it in both cases. You know, do you think that you are now kind of, do you think that the gap is closing between Australia and England? Because obviously, very much we've talked about there being this gap, and in the last couple of Women's Ashes in particular, that gap has been very apparent, with England really struggling to get any points on the board at all. So do you think that the gap is closing? Guess what Heather Knight said? Of course she said yes, it is closing. I really feel like we're going toe-to-toe with Australia. And you know, we didn't get over the line today, but we beat them 3 times, and we could potentially still draw the series. So she very much sees this in kind of in agreement with me, that actually is a bit of a shift in this kind of England-Australia rivalry. Alana King, on the other hand, says no, she doesn't see it as having closed the gap at all. She actually said, you know, basically we still think that we're just as far ahead as we were 6 months ago or a year ago or whatever, and that you know, basically anybody who thinks that we're not the side that we once were is just wrong. So I thought that was very interesting, and a kind of contrast in those two, in the perspectives of the two teams.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I agree with the Lion King in that case, but, you know, we'll find out over the next year or so, and we'll see that if, you know, Australia's, you know, kind of bubble has been punctured. Maybe it has, maybe you'll prove to be right, Raf.
Well, we've still got one match of this Ashes to go at Taunton on Tuesday. Looking forward to it being over in a way, because I'm so exhausted, but obviously it's been a brilliant series. I guess in a way that's one of the things that's made it so tiring, though, is that you just can't, you can't predict what's going to happen. You never quite know which side is going to get over the line, and that obviously presents its own challenges for us as journalists.
Certainly presents a challenge for any journalist that's got to file a report for The Guardian on the dot, Raf. And
yeah.
I did turn to you shortly, you know, about well, 5 hours left, and said, you know, are you doing the rewrite yet? And you were like, yeah, maybe I need to think about the possibility of England winning. And yeah, they did get close. I mean, it's important, you know, to understand that, you know, although I'm saying that I think that Australia, you know, are likely, I reckon, to maintain, you know, a lead, if perhaps not the dominance that they had in the previous generation. But, you know, it is a fantastic achievement by Heather Knight and her team to have got to this position, because everybody, and by everybody, I mostly mean me.
And me.
We wrote them off.
Yeah.
We said that they weren't going to be able to get anything like this. But we thought that, you know, Australia would win the series 16-0. You know, and there's still every possibility that the series comes out 8-all. So, you know, massive kudos to Heather Knight and to the coaching team. Now, you know, you think it's very much to do with the coaching team, don't you, Raf?
Well, that's what they've all been saying. They've been saying, it was interesting that Amy Jones said in the press conference yesterday that actually there was this moment, this point in the West Indies in December. England were on tour there. John Lewis's first tour as coach. And he sat them down and he said, you know, what makes you play well? And they all thought about it. And they said, well, it's when we feel kind of confident in our own abilities, and that the people around us are confident in our own abilities. And she's got sort of labelled that a turning point, because you know, John Lewis said, okay, great, well, I'm confident in your abilities, so I'm going to give you license to go out and play the ramp or play the reverse sweep. And okay, you live by the sweep, you die by the sweep. You live by John Ball, you die by John Ball. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But what we have certainly seen is a shift in the mentality of this England team, because genuinely, I believe them when at Bristol they said, Kate Cross comes in and we believe, even with 30 to win, needed to win, and 2 wickets in hand, that they were going to do it. And they did do it. Previous iterations, even of this same England team under Heather Knight with many of the same personnel, I do not believe would have had that confidence in their own abilities. And of course, we saw today they weren't successful, and it was a sort of similar rum chase situation in a way, but it was just a little bit too much to do right at the end. But there is a shift, I think, in the mentality. John Lewis, really nice bloke, don't really know him, haven't really had many interactions with him at all, if any, outside of formal press conference situations. But, you know, nice guy, seems fairly unassuming, but seems to be actually have done something quite remarkable with this team in a relatively short space of time. That's how I'm reading it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's definitely an achievement. Unfortunately, it's not the achievement quite that they wanted, but there's an achievement. So just on a sort of tactical level about the game today, and about this is something that John Lewis has done, one of the things that he's brought in is he's kind of this thing of like having a flexible batting order. And we saw that in particular today and over the last couple of weeks, because what we're seeing is that they send Alice Capsey in if they lose a wicket in the power play. If they don't lose a wicket in the power play, then Alice Capsey is coming in, you know, two or three slots later down the order, and she came in quite late down the order today, and she was still in that kind of license to play mode, but this time she was coming in at what, 5 or 6, and that was possibly not the right place for her to be coming in. How do you feel about that, Raf? Do you think that there's too much flexibility there, or do you think that Capsey might benefit from having a solid position at number 3?
Well, I mean, a lot of Australia's success has come with having an extremely flexible batting lineup, and I remember a couple of World Cups ago being quite scathing about this thing of like, oh, if what was there some stupid tweet that you put out about if a wicket falls when there's a red car driving past the ground and the pigeon swoops down, then Ash Gardner comes in. But if it doesn't and the bus is going the other way around the ground, then anyway, you get the point. It felt very arbitrary changes that they were making to their batting lineup. And part of this was their thing of, oh, we always need to have a right-hand, left-hand combination at the crease. I think that was one of the things that Matthew Mott said. Okay, fine. But it was actually quite successful for them in many ways. We took the mickey out of it, but, you know, brought them some success. I think that it's a trade-off, isn't it? Because sometimes as a batter, you like to know your role and you like to, you know, it would be nice to not just be tapped on the shoulder and be like, right, you're in now. You know, it would be nice to actually have some certainty about that. Obviously, you never know when the wicket's going to fall, but you know when it does fall, you're in. There is that kind of psychological element to it. On the other hand, sometimes, I don't know, other tactical, other people who have more tactical appreciation than me have said that it can be helpful. So I'm a little bit on the fence here, Sid, I'm afraid.
I just feel that Alice Capsey is she's the epitome of the John Ball player, you know, the sort of bravery and sort of going out and hitting. She did it again today, she got out hitting, and that's much more useful early in the game, and that was what put England in such a great position in the first ODI, because she was able to do that early in the game. But coming in, you know, a chunk later in the game, that made her life much harder. But well, let's see how England evolve that as well.
Yeah, so we've obviously got this one more match at Taunton left, and then we'll be doing a full and frank post-Ashes review in the next episode, when hopefully we've had a little bit more time to think and they're a little bit less tired. Let's talk about a couple of other things that have come up this week, Sid. The first was that we were wrong last week. So we sometimes are.
Shocked to hear
that. We sometimes are wrong. And thanks very much to Jack Rule for pointing out that our conversation about the schedule for next summer actually omitted a very important element, because we were talking about the fact that England didn't have any home fixtures in September because we thought they were going to try and organise something perhaps in India ahead of the World Cup in Bangladesh, which is scheduled for late September, October. Jack Rule points out that according to the ICC's Future Tours programme for women, England are actually due to play Ireland in Ireland next September. I did check, and Jack, you're absolutely correct. So well done. Thanks for picking us up on that.
That's right.
So that'll be interesting. Still an equally busy schedule. Don't know if we're going to manage to make it to Ireland, but we could have a good go. it's less far to go than some of the bilateral series that England play. Jack did also ask a question, Sid, because we did talk about the schedule for next summer, and he says, what are your feelings about it being very localised and not spread across the country? So for example, 4 T20s v New Zealand, all in the South East and London in a week, plus a fifth in Southampton here. He says it doesn't feel right. So any thoughts on that? I have thoughts.
Yeah, I think he has a point. And I think that, you know, we do owe the North something, you know. But I think the fundamental constraint here is now a financial one, that they needed to squash a series into quite a short amount of time. They didn't want to have the players having to do, you know, 13-hour bus journeys. So they have to kind of compress that and make that work, you know, financially, and make it work in terms of the time constraints to allow them to get round all those grounds in such a short space of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but ultimately, at some point, we'd love to see them play a bit more in the North as well.
I would, because it's more travel for us, Sid, if we're selfishly inclined. No, I think, yeah, it's. I was thinking about it from a fan perspective as well, because one of the things that we saw when we did the research into the 100 is actually that people talked about this ability to be able to earmark a week in the summer during the 100 and go, okay, I'm going to go to those matches and they're all near me and I can get to all of them and I know I can get between them easily. For example, teachers in the summer holidays. Now, of course, you don't have that outside of the summer holidays, but you do have like a more fan-friendly schedule in the sense of, okay, I'm going to take a week off work and I know that I've got minimal travel to do between the matches. So that could potentially be a rationale for this kind of schedule. But of course, then what you need to do is really rotate the schedule. You need to have one time where you have a series like that in the south, one in the north, one in the Midlands. Probably people in the north are thinking, well, hang on, we're not just in the north. The north is quite big. And so we have one in the northwest, one in the northeast, etc., etc. So actually, you need to then spread those
spread the goodies.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the answer to that. But thank you very much for that, Jack. And finally this week, Sid, big announcement from the ICC. Huge, potentially. They have said that from now on, going forward, there's going to be equal prize money for ICC men's and women's tournaments. Now, I understand that this is actually effective immediately. So the next ICC tournament is the Men's 50 Over World Cup, if I'm correct, which starts in October this year. I read that somewhere. I have no idea what the men's schedule actually looks like normally. And next year, in 2024, there is a Men's T20 World Cup and a Women's T20 World Cup. So, very interesting announcement this. One thing that was missing from it was, what's the prize money actually going to be? I didn't see that. And you do wonder whether, because obviously the women's prize money has been down here and the men's prize money has been a little bit up here. Are they bringing them together like that? Or are they bumping the women's one up? So are they going to actually take some money away from the men to give to the women? Because obviously that's something that we've talked about within the English context, being politically unpalatable. So maybe that's why it's not in the press release. But what did you make of that announcement, Sid?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these things are important symbolically, but it's still important to remember that there's an enormous gulf between what the men and the women are earning overall, what their total remuneration is. So the men are still making far more money from, you know, their match fees and from, you know, their appearance fees and from their marketing and all of that kind of stuff. So there's still a long way to go before we've achieved equality. But I think that there is some importance in symbolic steps, as long as we all acknowledge that, you know, that they're largely symbolic and we don't think, okay, this is the job done. And I think that that's the risk that people go sit back and go, okay, job done. And it's really interesting in the context of the report that we had a couple of weeks ago into the state of English cricket, that the people who drew up the equity report were very clear that the ECB did need to not just go, well, we'll make the prize money equal. So they talked specifically about the 100 and said, you know, even if you make the prize money equal, which obviously they had done, you know, there's still this huge, you know, disparity between what, you know, the average woman is taking home and what the average man is taking home. So, you know, there's still a way to go, but it's all positive.
I guess the ICC doesn't have control over the salaries. That's up to the individual governing bodies. So perhaps this is something that the ICC feels that it can do as the kind of international umbrella organisation. Must say, I'm quite surprised by it, because as I tweeted at the time, it was only recently that the ICC, or that senior people within the ICC, were saying that equal prize money was described memorably as economically absurd by one individual. So yeah, it's refreshing to see that this has happened, and that it's happened ahead of schedule, because I believe they had committed to it happening by 2030. Well, that's still 7 years away. So well done the ICC, you got one thing right, congratulations. Let's wrap up there, Sid. I want to go home to bed, and I'm sure you do as well. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you in a week's time. Bye.